This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Catherine Williams, who is a clinical psychologist, a visual artist, and most of all, a poet. And here's Catherine with a poem.
The idea of skin. At the hospital, after I gave permission to cut off his ring, they handed me a ragged, split thing I finger in my pocket until the day I wonder why I spared his skin instead of the smooth, cold ring, as though the idea of his body died a slower death than he and was still wrapped around me. Time and ashes shattered, I glimpse myself against the rain in a dark window, feel my body raw, as if a protective film I never knew I wore is peeled to expose the veins beneath. In the harsh light inside the store, I stroke piles of purple eggplants, envying the taut skin that protects the creamy flesh within.
Catherine Williams, I want to teach your work because there is nothing you have felt that you have not said. What a lesson that is. With skill, you hold back nothing, and you use language like lace to tell us about it. Now, am I right about this full disclosure of your emotional life?
Well, I think there's always things that maybe I don't even know, but I do want to be true to what I felt, what I'm feeling, and I do think that writing a poem is a way into that. Sometimes I don't know until I write the poem what I actually am feeling.
What is in the book? Still Life. What is in that book?
That book is my life, and I think there are poems written over time. My husband died back when I was 52, and I'm 83 now. So I chose the title because it is a series of still lifes, of moments in my life, but also because I had to kind of lean into meaning and find that there was still life of some sort.
It's such a wonderful title because it also alludes to your paintings.
Yes.
So it's just an ideal title. Well, let's hear another poem, okay, Catherine Williams.
Well, the next poem I'll read is called Still Life. It's the title poem of the book. And there's, in this poem, Zubarán, 16th century Spanish painter, is mentioned. And he does these exquisite still lifes where humble, kind of domestic items are pictured beautifully. And you see them for what they are, but also for the sense that they too will, the lemons will decay and the flowers will decay. And so it's a statement about life as well. Hmm. So here's the poem. Still Life. Most mornings, I don't see the pillow still fresh from yesterday's making. On a night when the air is a thicket of heat, I search for the cool pool of sheet on the other side of the bed. In this new economy, the currency is initiative. I set the table for 7, specialize in the anthropology of 3. I'm an accidental citizen of a country where things stay put, where I sleep when tired. In the old dispensation, travel meant time to be a tourist in each other's bodies, foreign land as background. Now, I practice being a lover to the world, tracing the shoulders of a new city, tasting its breath. But tonight, my house guest calls his wife. Late, laundry, tarmac, the words like the cups and petals in a Zubarán painting, intimate reminders of a larger, fleeting life.
Grief is something, that's one of our poet's jobs, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the things that we're in charge of. But one grief is not at all like another's.
It's each one is particular, and I think in some ways each one is universal. The words that the epigraph for the whole book comes from Marie Howe, from her book, The Good Thief, and it reads, "It was like that, and after that, it was still like that, only all the time."
I like that very much. However, it's inimitable because your story is not my story.
Right.
And yet, it's the same story.
Exactly.
And yet, there are other themes in your book, but let's hear another poem.
So the book goes back to childhood, and this is a lesson from childhood. The lesson. I stand on the kitchen table, its old wood cool and smooth under my bare feet. Looking down, I see my mother's braids, hair pinned across her head, so they make a sort of bridge over the part through her hair. The eyes of the stove look up at me, and I notice the brown stain on the white enamel where the kettle melted the night my father forgot to turn it off. It feels grand up here. I must stand very still while my mother matches the sliding metal notch on the Wells & Company yardstick to a place on the dress she is sewing for me. She marks it with a pin from the felt pincushion with the pink edge. Every once in a while, she asks me to turn, and I do, slowly, like the ballerina on the top of the jewelry box when it's about to run down. Suddenly, the kitchen seems very warm, and something cold spreads through me as the room goes dark, and I find myself cheek on table, all fluttery inside. My mother tells me I've fainted, and I'm glad it has a name. But as I sit up with my feet dangling, sipping the cool water my aunt has brought me, the kitchen looks changed. And my body now knows that the world can fall away in an instant while I am looking someplace else.
Why did you write that poem?
I maybe wrote it partly because that I realized I had that experience in childhood. I had another experience in childhood where my mother tucked me in, went to bed, and then was paralyzed during the night and never walked again. And then my husband dropped dead on the sidewalk in New York. So it, thinking back on childhood, I never made the connection between that time I fainted and those other sudden changes in my life. But I realized I was especially attuned to those.
Special message given to you. Then give us more of a context for your childhood, the poems that visit you as a younger person and the situation that gave rise to those poems.
Well, I grew up on a college campus, and I for some reason, perhaps because my childhood was so dramatically changed, because then my mother went away to a hospital and then to a rehab center for a long time. But I have a very clear memory of learning a new word or walking with my father. And those, when I started to think back, those memories came flooding through.
And we are the lucky recipients because we're going to hear another.
Evensong. And this takes place on the college campus where my father taught.
What college was it?
Hamilton College in upstate New York.
Yes, and what did he teach?
English, 18th century English literature.
We get the DNA.
Okay. Evensong. When the blue shadow of the elm edges across the lawn, we head to the woods, my hand in the hard, smoky hand above me. Sounds of students slide away as we pass the campus, and the hush dusk drapes around us thick and cool. The last of the day's wasps lazily rise from smashed apples that sink in the ground as the swish of grasshoppers through high grass gives way to crickets easing under evening, calling for a mate. our whey grazed down to feeling muzzy, light furs the edges. We're lured by the dark that is not dark, by the scent of decay, the sense of a path, the loud hush of high trees crowded together. I am thinking of the unseen snails curled in their coiled beds, squirrels snuggled in leafy drays above us. I don't think of what my father is thinking in this silence that is not silence. He and I will turn with the woods at our back like wind, pass through pool upon pool of streetlight across the campus, into the house where my mother sleeps in her high invalid's bed. He will tuck me in, leave on one light. Out on the porch, the smoke from his cigarette will curl around his yellowed fingers as peepers throb in the faded elms. The orchard has not yet been raised to make space for new buildings. His lungs still fill with the moist night air.
Catherine, that tone shows me a lot about your relationship with him, and I'm feeling that he was a pretty good replacement if you had to have one parent. Is that true?
Well, I still had, in remarkable ways, I still had my mother, in that even though she was an invalid, she taught herself how to sew again and taught herself how to cook again. So I still had her in many ways, but he was a very attentive parent.
And the walking outdoors with
him is
something no one
something
else could do.
I could not do with my
and
mother.
You have captured that, and you are really a noticer.
Yes.
We get the scent, we get the smell, we get the sight, we get all of the senses in that one poem. How did you recollect them?
They just, once you sit there in a room with a pen in your hand and a piece of paper, they come back.
Yes, everybody, hear that? All you have to do is just be still for a minute.
Right.
Just be still for a minute. Do you think that this complicated childhood was partly informed your wish to be a clinical psychologist and to help other people? I know you had a private practice. I know you've taught in a university. But do you believe that being taught to be empathetic so early by necessity informed your profession?
I think probably. And I think, I did spend quite a bit of time alone, and I made art, and I wrote poems, and then stopped for all the years I directed the art therapy program at GW. I was not writing poems. I was doing artwork. But I do think, Winnicott, the child psychoanalyst and pediatrician, writes about that area of experience that is unchallenged by logic, that is the play in the deepest sense, and that's where creativity comes from. And art and religion are areas in this kind of transitional space. And I think that's partly what led me to pursue art and pursue writing, because I felt like that was where I became alive and where everybody knows things about themselves, but they don't know that they know them until you provide the chance for them to experience
it. What was that sentence, unchallenged?
Unchallenged experience. It doesn't have to be logical, but it's deeper and real and more profound.
I like that it, without the executive brain kicking in too early. And so we want to talk about art therapy in a minute, but I want another poem. This is from Still Life. It is Catherine Williams. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're actually at the Library of Congress.
This one is one that actually isn't in a book that you edited, the Poet's Cookbook. And, another way to sort of empathically enter into others' experience is to just let your imagination enter into the experience. And this is an overheard remark, based on an overheard remark. I didn't know the person, I didn't know the circumstances, but I heard someone say, and this is the epigraph to the poem, "The day after my grandfather died, my grandmother ate mushrooms for the first time in 60 years. And so I wrote this poem called Choices, based on just my imaginative excursion into this stranger's life. Did she forage in the understory on pearly summer mornings, the bright orange crenellations spelling chanterelles, each year's growth springing up untouched for the man who refused to taste, smell, touch a mushroom? Did she dream of morels, tiny colonies of fragrant cells bubbling in butter while her body lay cupped inside his in that long marriage of sleep? Did she awaken in the hollow of the night following the liminal smell of porcini floating in broth only to slowly sense his sleeping body, the sweet scent of him in the dark? Would she, perhaps, while he was far in the fields, turn to the unstained pages of cookbooks, the pristine sections lying flat between the rippled recipes for seasons of puddings and roasts? On the morning after the first night she'd slept alone in 60 years, did she rise early, pull her boots over stiff ankles, take herself to the harsh chill of the store to finger musty piles of cremenes, umbrellas of portobellos, little moons of common mushrooms, the memory of earth on her hands?
What a saga. What a scenario. Now, you have posed the questions of what this woman might have done upon the death of her husband. But tell us why you think she might have done this. Why did she want to try this? Something never done before. What do you think?
Well, you know, I wrote a poem based on hearing a lecture from Sean Scully, the painter, where he doesn't have a plan for the painting. He takes little blocks of color and then he does the next block of color based on what the last block of color was. And I thought I was going to be writing a poem about art and that sort of thing. But as I wrote it, I realized that's life, and that's a marriage. And that's so that because of who the other person is, then you respond in certain ways. And because of what he can't do, you do, and what you vice versa. And so that in that poem, I wrote the whole thing and ended with a question that surprised me, which was, can this person ever become what she never was because of the other? And I think that's something about marriage. And so here this woman always loved mushrooms, but the guy couldn't even stand to have them around.
That was it.
And so she had always had this, and she would always kind of look at mushroom recipes and what all, but now she's trying to find the thing that she can live into that's still life. And it's going to the store and looking at those mushrooms and then coming home. And
much more superficial response. I thought she just needed something different, just something to jolt her, so some taste that was different.
Well,
but you have elaborated it so much better. And that is in the Poet's Cookbook, and it is a great poem. I had actually, when I saw your new book, Still Life, I thought, I've heard this story before about the mushroom.
Right, you did.
And
you
now
did.
We know why. And so I know that nature is your muse, and you have put it on the page like no one else. So give us another poem. You are a naturalist as well as some other things.
Yeah, there's a section in the book that it talks about aging, and this is part of that section. It's called Labyrinth. I don't know where the mind goes or what sort of clock it has. It's as though my brain crackles along its neuronal path while my mind floats up with the dark bird at the top of the live oak and looks down at poor earthbound me, stepping over scat fresh on the path since yesterday. This morning, I feel alone and small, shrunken, full of porous bone. I miss those inches I've lost. To the east, the tick-ridden deer on the hill are silhouettes, majestic and black. The doe reaches down to the fawn. Step and step, breath, then breath, and I turn into the center. Ring, note, tiny cairn, scattered blue stones. I don't know how this happens. I'm standing, arms out, grateful for centuries of talismans, intimate continents of things. And then I remember what I said this morning to someone who called me by the wrong name. No matter is what I said. I answer to anything. But this is a lie. The universe, its elements, and its people has called to me, and I've turned away. I stay still here for a while until my feet begin to follow the path. I notice her as I turn west, lean and dark, her pace matching mine. I look for her each time I round the curve by the fallen tree. No, she's behind me as I look toward the lake the fog has made of the valley this morning. As I reach the end of the walk, I raise my arms and she raises hers, my shadow stretching from my feet all the way up the hill.
What a mixture of feelings, all identified with the visual. What a mix you have there of contemplation and exhilaration and sadness. So many things going on. You went through a lot writing that poem. Did it take a long time?
The first draft came very quickly because I had had the walk and I came back and I wrote. But then it took me a while to sort of, there was a lot more, there was a lot more underbrush that I had to clear out.
Yes, in a vision, right? Mm-hmm. And so would you say it took 5 hours? I'm just curious.
Oh, I have no idea, Grace. Oh, okay. I have no idea.
I just like to clock you.
Yes.
I just want to clock
right.
you. I know you are an artist of great reputation, and you foster the arts, and you practice the arts, and you present the arts. But when you were in charge of the program of art therapy at George Washington University, that was quite different. What is art therapy?
Well, art therapy is a sort of a way in through a nonverbal, of course it's not nonverbal, but it's a way in through another realm. And I think, you know, going back to the Winnicott experience, it's that helping people to see, find out things about themselves that as I was saying, they already know in some way, but they haven't let themselves know. And so that one of the things I think that's important about art therapy, people have this idea, oh, I'll make some marks on the paper and then it'll be kind of like snake oil or whatever, you know, someone that this art therapist will look, she'll tell me everything about myself and then I'll know. But it isn't like that. It's more a sense of we'll look at what you make together and then we'll see what comes up for you. Are there surprises, you know, and helping the person to see that actually they do know things about themselves can be helpful.
Is it verbal, on the text, or with color, or all those things?
It's everything. I mean, in my art therapy practice, which I had for years, sometimes we would spend a whole session talking, but then there'd be that moment when the patient would say, I think I want to do some art about this, or the person would come in and not be able to think what to do that day or what to talk about, and then maybe they would start to make some art, and then we would be with that art. So it's a sort of a different way for people to get to know themselves.
Could you chart progress?
Yeah, when I worked in institutions where I needed to chart progress, I could. But otherwise, it's the whole part of the relationship. It's like there's the artwork, there's the patient or client, and there's myself. And we sense either I or the patient or both will sense this is something different. Or you can look at a series of pictures and see that there's been change.
So people, would they come to art therapy as they would to a clinical psychologist as a session?
Yes.
I see.
Yeah.
And do you think that it's promulgating in this country? And do you think that arts therapy is being respected as a clinical way of healing?
I do. Certainly back when I started, I was the first full-time art therapy faculty at GW, and that wasn't so much the case. But I do think that it's much more the case now.
You know what worries me? I know some people that are going to teach poetry as means of emotional expression and relief, and that is fine. But when I had tough things said, when I'm teaching colleges or upper levels, and they say some pretty tough stuff, I know I'm not a therapist, so I keep it on the page.
Yeah.
And I say, you know, they might say something very harsh about their parents, and I might say, well, that could be a longer line length.
Yeah, so right, yeah.
I believe that the person who's not a therapist, they better keep it on the page. And it worries me when other people practice that want to interpret that.
Yeah.
You know, writing teachers. But I guess not too much harm can be done if they're merciful, right?
Right. I mean, but I do think this with writing and with art, that the most important thing is whatever we can do to sort of be the midwife to their own creation.
Yes, but not to make pronouncements, perhaps, about it. If you're just a writing teacher, that's where the therapist.
Well,
so to do art therapy, not everyone is a clinical psychologist.
No, that's right.
But good things are happening.
Yes.
Okay. And let's have another poem. Then that's another good thing that's going to happen for us. Catherine Williams is here, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
So this one is Place Setting. This is not in the book.
A premiere,
yes. This one will come out in the Delmarva Review in the next year's book. It's called Place Setting. My favorite, the chubby salad fork, perfectly formed to hold a slippery leaf of butter lettuce or a golden bite of almond cake. I set it to the left of the mat, right of the dinner fork, like a priest preparing the sacrament. The silver candlesticks turn dim so soon, it's almost as though the dark is in there, waiting to come out when I turn my back. At the sink, my hands cup pink polish as the unacknowledged oath of water fills the bowl. Someone in Aleppo dips her finger in a broken jar to wet the lips of her little girl. The radio voice attuned to death intones lives lost, homes folding as the earth convulsed. My heart does its new bump and flutter that the doctor says he's watching. And for a minute, I'm looking down on my little house in this placid street after the streetlights have flicked on. Friends outside the door are knocking. How is it I am here holding old blue napkins that fold themselves from years of use?
The object. And a final poem.
Last Night. I always liked that monk who, while planting a hill of beans, was asked what he would do if he knew he would die that night. The one who said, I would finish planting this row of beans. Sort of like that time I took an antibiotic that made me a little crazy and I woke in the middle of the night thinking, this must be it, I'm dying. I'll put in a load of wash so my girls won't have to do it when they come. But now that I'm closer to dying, I'm wondering what I would do if I knew I would die tonight. It would be too late to take a trip, which although Venice was alluring and I wouldn't trade sitting on the floor of the hut in the kraal in the pure dark beyond the lights of Durban watching worshippers dance their ancestors down, I don't really like. Travel itself, I mean. All that packing and worry about losing things. But here I am wasting my time before dying thinking of what I don't want to do, and that's a habit I'd certainly eradicate if there were an instant way to do that. What I would want is to say friable and know enough about rocks to name the elements that crumbled from the green chunk in my hand. Say succulent, Lucullus, and broccoli without needing sentences to contain them. It's too late, and has been for years before I knew this was the night it would all end, to apologize for the inadvertent or calculated cruelties I've wreaked on those I loved. Too late to remember secrets people told me that I've since forgotten. But if there were time, I would swim naked in a cold lake at just that moment when your body disappears and you're pure, weightless being. And if I could do this at night, I'd be lying on my back, becoming water, breathing stars overhead. When you do this, you only have a few minutes before you're in too long and beyond knowing that. Someone else needs to pull you out so your flesh doesn't throb with every painful beat of your heart. But as water safety books advise, you should warm up flesh to flesh. And I would definitely want flesh to flesh, especially with someone I'd known through most of the ages we've lived, so that as we hold each other, we're feeling the memory of the creamy flesh of youth beneath the final folding tissue of this skin.
The voice of Catherine Williams from the book Still Life. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, by the Sinipet Fund, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.